Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Welcome to the Daily Jungle. You clones must be very happy with yourselves. You did your very best to run this show right into the wall, but somehow, someway, I kept this thing on track like I always do. Because while I was talking about the complicated legacy of Shaun White, you were talking about Dane Cook getting fat. While I was defending Steve Kerr for letting his guys coach themselves, you were hitting me with Menendez brother smack. At least my guests made the show better. USA Today's Martin Rogers called in live in the middle of the night from the Olympics in South Korea. Kevin Harvick, the driver of the number four car, did what he always does. And live in studio, LA Chargers linebacker Denzel Perryman made a great jungle debut. Alvy, who made yet another appearance on the show today, gets better and better every single time he does. What do you say, Alvin, if it's not too much to ask, and you're not too big of a star now, can you just go ahead and get this thing started? Yesterday, we talked about Chloe Kim. And when she broke out in a huge, fresh way on the women's halfpipe, that was really significant in that it was fresh and new. However, nothing new or fresh about what Shaun White did in the men's halfpipe. I mean, not new, not fresh, just epic. He won gold in 06, he won gold in 2010, then he missed the podium altogether in 2014. And now he was back for gold once again. He went hard in training, right up until the greatest rider of a generation suffered the worst crash of his entire life in October. If you know that story, he attempted to land a cab double cork 1440. He ends up bruising his lungs, smashing his face, and he needed 62 stitches and a 5-day stay in the hospital. It was that bad. But then the guy came back with a vengeance, looking for redemption. And he nearly had it on the first of three runs in the final when he threw down a 94.25. However, Ayumu Hirano of Japan ripped the lead, and that gave him, he had a pair of 1440s himself, and that gave him a 95.25 on his second run, which meant it all came down to White's final run. The only way to win gold would be land, two 1440s of his own, including the same cab double cork 1440 that ruined his face in New Zealand just 5 months ago. So when he drops in for his final run, he nails the frontside double cork 1440. He then chases that with the cab double cork 1440, a combination that he had never even done before in competition. And then he finishes off a near flawless ride. And then, of course, the long wait for the scores. And when they finally came, 97.75, another gold, the third Olympic gold of his career, the 100th gold medal for America at the Winter Olympics, and redemption. The man had redemption. Sort of. I mean, sort of. Because here's the thing that's always tricky about sports. Yesterday was redemption for Shaun White as a snowboarder. And it came in the most amazing way possible. He had to go where he had never gone before, had to land a combination of tricks that he had never done before, and pull off the trick that put him in the hospital with a smashed face. In other words, he had to face down that fear to go legend once again, and he did. So, most amazing male snowboarder ever, without a doubt. One of the most clutch performances I've ever seen on a big stage. Absolutely. But, redemption for Shaun White? Yet not so sure about that. Because this is the same Shaun White who was sued for sexual harassment by a former bandmate. The allegations in the lawsuit are disgusting. I mean, honestly. So White paid an undisclosed amount to settle that lawsuit. After the competition, he was asked whether the lawsuit might tarnish his legacy, and he said, and I quote, "I'm here to talk about the Olympics, not gossip and stuff. I don't think so. I'm proud of who I am. My friends, you know, love me and vouch for me. I believe that stands for itself." End of quote. Wrong answer, Red. He knew it. He knew it because later in the interview with NBC, he apologized for his words saying, quote, "I'm truly sorry that I chose the word gossip. It was a poor choice of words to describe such a sensitive subject in the world today," end quote. Getting warmer. especially if you actually mean it. So let's just go ahead and pump the brakes on all this redemption talk. As I've always said, but it keeps needing to be said time and time again, we do not know these people. We don't know them at all. There is no doubt that yesterday was an amazing moment for Shaun White, the snowboarder. But let's not draw any conclusions or make any declarations beyond that. A pair of 1440s may erase the pain of Sochi, but it does not erase a sexual harassment lawsuit. Yesterday was about one thing, and one thing only. An amazing snowboarder did a truly amazing thing on a snowboard, and that's it. Athletic accomplishment? Absolutely. Personal redemption? Not so much. From South Korea, my guest is Martin Rogers. Martin, it is so good to have you back on. How are you?
I'm good, Jim. You're right. It is a few continents now. I think we're up to four, maybe. It's pretty cool.
At least four. I'll get into that in a minute. But before we get into anything at all that you've been covering at the Winter Olympics, I want to pay my respects, and I want my listeners, Martin, to know exactly how hard you've worked to make this conversation happen. What time is it right now where you are, and how is your life?
It's 2:20 a.m., Jim, and it's a new kind of reality where 3.5 hours sleep a night is actually a bonus. So it's all good. I only stayed up an extra 15 minutes to talk to you guys. So always a pleasure to do so.
My man, thanks so much for doing that. Now, I said this, I've been going back over in my mind, and off the top of my head, we have spoken when you were in South Africa, when you were in Germany, when you were in Brazil, to name just a few countries, and now you're in South Korea. What have been your impressions of the first few days of the 2018 Winter Olympics?
I think it's been a good Olympics, but I think it's an Olympics that's really defined by storylines that aren't so much about sports. I mean, politics are obviously a huge part of life in this part of the world. And you see it, and you see it everywhere. You see it in the venues. You see it around the city of Pyeongchang. You see it around the city of Gangneung, which is the sort of sister city where a lot of the events are too. And you see it in every kind of sense. I mean, the biggest stars of the opening ceremony weren't necessarily the performers. It was the lookalikes of Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump who were walking through the stands. I mean, the biggest stars of the first week of the event have been the North Korean cheerleading section that turn up from everything from figure skating to speed skating to ice hockey. And it's a different kind of Olympic feel. And I think we sense also that maybe the American public are consuming it in a different way because of the time difference and all that kind of stuff. And look, the sports are still great and they're still huge. And a big star is a big star, whether it's Shaun White or Chloe Kim or whoever. But this is an Olympics with a twist. For me, it's slightly different.
Martin Rogers joining us. He's live from South Korea. Well said. So, Martin, what about Shaun White? He wins the gold medal in the half pipe with an amazing performance. And as you wrote, in the lead up to the games, you were ready to declare him the most significant American Winter Olympian ever. Before we get into how that has changed, what would the case have been for him to be the most significant American Winter Olympian ever?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jim. And the reason would be not based on the number of gold medals, because he doesn't have the most. There are other athletes in past Olympics. Eric Heiden won 5 gold medals in 1 Olympics. But the reason would be the cultural shift that we've seen in the Winter Olympics over the last, 20 years or so. The Winter Olympics has become cooler. It's become more about sort of events like the half pipe, about snowboard and freestyle skiing and different kind of stuff that brings an X Games kind of element to the competition. And Shaun White really just picked that up and embraced it from the very beginning. And he brought this sense of style and swagger, and it was a crossover appeal. It was the kind of thing that people who maybe wouldn't have watched the Winter Olympics or weren't even interested particularly in sport before could get something out of watching this guy compete and watching the way he conducted himself. And that's why I think before this Games, I thought for a long, long time, I thought if this guy wins again, 3rd gold medal, he's going to be the greatest American Winter Olympian.
Clones. Can I have a moment to talk to you about Stamps.com? It goes without saying that the U.S. Postal Service is an important tool for any business reaching every household every single day. Now, Stamps.com is the easiest way to access all the amazing services of the post office. Stamps.com never closes. You can print postage for letters or packages at your convenience 24/7. You can print postage for any mail class right from your own computer. with the exact amount of postage every single time, so you never underpay or overpay. And Stamps.com saves you time and money, which you can use to grow your business. I love Stamps.com, and the reason I use Stamps.com is because it is convenient, it is easy, it is reliable, it is so efficient, it saves me so much time. I love this product. And right now, you too can enjoy the Stamps.com service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale. So go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Jungle. To get this deal, go to Stamps.com and enter the code name Jungle. I love this product. I know you will too. That's Stamps.com, and now it's back to our Daily Jungle. Martin Rogers joining us, 2:20 in the morning in South Korea. Martin, at the same time, of course, he has been sued by a former bandmate for sexual harassment. So how do you square the Shaun White that we see on the half pipe with the Shaun White who's been described in that lawsuit? How does one impact the other?
It really does. I think when you think about White, I was talking about his impact on a number of different levels. Obviously, he's a tremendous athlete, and he's had an incredible amount of success. But for me, what would have made him the greatest was this cultural crossover that he was involved with. And when you factor in something like this, but particularly given the current climate, the Me Too movement, and everything that's happening in America today, when you thrust him into that conversation, it diminishes from the cultural impact that he's had. It has to. It just has to, the way that people react to this kind of stuff these days. It's very, very significant. And, it's unfortunate that it sort of raised its head at this time, but it can't be ignored. There's no question about that. And look, in different sports, it is different. Floyd Mayweather is unquestionably the greatest boxer of modern times, notwithstanding the fact that he's been accused and been convicted of all kinds of negative stuff. But with White, it's different because of the way he took snowboard and he took these sort of extreme sports, made them part of the winter movement, changed the face of the Winter Olympics. That's why this kind of caveat applies to him.
Martin Rogers joining us once again live from South Korea. You know, you mentioned the breakout stars, and it's still early in the games, but I want to ask you about figure skater Adam Rippon. You made the point that he might not win gold, but he'll be the biggest figure skating star of the Olympics, in part because the guy's an absolute, quote, machine. As an example, he told you that, quote, I really like my slutty costumes, end quote. You've spent some time with him. How would you describe his personality?
Jim, I love the way you do research, mate. You've dug that one out. Yep. Adam Rippon is an absolute superstar. And I thought this before the games, and I had a colleague say to me, oh, you know what? I mean, the problem is the guy's probably going to finish 12th or something. And he may well. Like, he's not the best figure skater in the world, but the guy is personality personified. Remember Johnny Weir back in Vancouver in 2010, and he became a big star. He finished 6th back then. And there was an American, Evan Lysacek, who won that event, and no one remembers him whatsoever. Adam Rippon is going to be Johnny Weir to a factor of 50. People are going to absolutely fall in love with him even more when he competes again. He's a, like you say, he's a quote machine. He looks great. Like, his costumes are unbelievable. And people just react to that kind of personality, someone who puts themselves out there so unashamedly. He just is completely comfortable in his own skin. And you see that kind of star quality. And when you have that kind of sparkle about you, it really doesn't matter if you're topping the podium or not, especially in a sport like figure skating, where it's really about performance. It's an art form. Of course, it's a sport, but it's different. Listen, this isn't the NFL, right, where winning is everything. It's about the impact you have on people's lives. Adam Rippon makes people smile. People will be tuning in within moments of his performance in the team competition the other day. He was the number one trending topic on Twitter in the United States. That's going to happen even more so when he competes in the individuals. And yes, Jim, I can confirm, in the name of investigative journalism, he does like his slutty costume.
Martin Rogers joining us live from South Korea, on point, on his game in the middle of the night. Also, one of the ongoing stories throughout the game has been the dynamic between South Korea and North Korea. How would you describe that so far?
It's funny. I mean, if you'd have asked me 2 weeks before the Olympics, you might have said, oh, it's probably going to be tense. It's not tense at all. The South Koreans absolutely love the fact that the North Koreans are here. They have this fascination because they feel it's their brothers and sisters but they've just been brought up in a completely different way. They love the fact that the figure skaters are here. There was a North Korean figure skating pair who competed earlier. They got an unbelievable reception from the South Korean fans. And those cheerleaders, who you see them everywhere. You see them at the hockey arena. You see them at different places. They're waving, they're cheering. And the South Koreans absolutely love them. And for a while, at least, the tension has dissipated between these two countries. Now, look, you know, we've seen sporting diplomacy before, and in a lot of cases, especially between North and South Korea, it hasn't worked. So is this going to lead to a reunification of the Koreas and long-lasting peace? Almost certainly not. But look, for the people of South Korea, who have effectively lived with the threat of nuclear warheads over their head for the last 40 years, it's a very nice, brief respite, and I think they're all enjoying it.
Martin Rogers joining us for a few more moments. He is appearing live in South Korea. He's a broadcaster and a sports writer for USA Today Sports. I mean, Martin, the number of things that you're writing is so prolific. There's no way we could cover them all in one segment, but I do want to ask you about one thing in particular, a story involving Sister Catherine of the Franciscan Sisters of the Renewal. For those who do not know, who is Sister Catherine?
Yeah, this is great. I mean, this is a real heartwarming story for me. Her name was Kirsten Hollum. She was a short track speed skater, and she came effectively from American speed skating royalty. She competed in Nagano in 1998 as a 17-year-old. Her mum, Diane Hollum, was a gold medal winning speed skater as well. And just when it looked like she was going to become the future of American long track speed skating, she gave it all up. And then she became a nun, and that's what she still is today. And she kind of uses, the fact that she was a Winter Olympian and has had that sporting background to really appeal to young people and sort of connect with them and try to help the poor and needy. She's based in a convent in Leeds in England, but does sort of missionary work around the world. And, I got to know her maybe 8 years ago ahead of the Vancouver Olympics. And back then, she didn't really talk much about the fact that she was a former Olympian. But now she does. She embraces it, sometimes talks in front of several thousand people about her experiences. And this is just one of those Olympic stories that we like. The Olympics aren't necessarily about the sports themselves, about the personalities, the narratives, and the storylines. And that's one of my favorites.
All right, so before I let you go for that 3 hour sleep, or 3 hours of sleep you're going to get, what events and stories are you covering for the rest of this week?
Yeah, there's a whole lot, but figure skating is going to be big, Jim. I also cover the short and long track speed skating, but the Americans are doing absolutely terrible in that. So I think for the rest of the week, all eyes are going to be on the figure skating. Nathan Chen, who's going to be in the men's figure skating competition, as well as Adam Rippon, is a gold medal favorite. And I'm just fascinated to see who turns out being the more popular. Is it going to be the guy who's probably going to win the gold medal and does these insane quadruple jumps? He does five of them in one routine. It's an incredibly difficult move that no one even did 10 years ago. Is he going to be the star coming out of this, or is it going to be the guy with the big smile on his face and the flamboyant personality in Adam Rippon? We're only a couple of days away from finding out. It's going to be a whole lot of fun, and it's going to be an NBC primetime, so it's going to be worth tuning in.
Let's talk about the Cavaliers for a minute. Cleveland 120, Oklahoma City 112. Somebody break up the Cavs. Actually, it's already been done. Actually, they've already been rebuilt better than they were before. They're better, they're stronger, they're faster. Well, actually, it's only been two games with that new lineup, and this one came against an OKC team that is not the same without Andre Roberson. So let's not go all Mike Powell on the conclusion jumping, but I'll be damned if they don't look better. Actually, they don't look better. They look completely different. This team looks nothing like the one that was blowing huge leads to the Orlando Magic or getting smoked by the Thunder and the Rockets and the Raptors, and the T-Wolves, and pretty much anybody else who happened to get five guys in matching gear together for a run. And the reason they look completely different is because they are completely different. They're younger, they're faster, they're more athletic, they're much better defensively, and they're working together. They cause you problems at both ends of the court right now. And I got to be honest, I didn't see this coming. Not this fast. I mean, I knew they'd be younger and faster and more athletic. I mean, that's pretty obvious. Because frankly, they couldn't have gotten any older, slower, or less athletic than they already were. But for everybody to get on the same page and gel this quickly, I mean, that's borderline impossible. And it's not just one new guy making a difference. It's all of the new guys. Larry Nance Jr., 13 points, 8 offensive rebounds, 3 blocks. Rodney Hood, 14 points. Jordan Clarkson, 14 points. George Hill, 7 points, 4 assists, 0 turnovers. And outside of Nance's domination on the offensive glass, none of those numbers are going to blow you away, but they make a world of difference, especially to LeBron James, who has blown out his voice, communicating with his new teammates and trying to get them on the same page.
Kobe did a heck of a job of understanding what our team needed. You know, it just wasn't working out for us. You know, he felt like, you know, obviously you guys saw his quotes, and he made the changes that he felt that best fits our team. And then it's on me to make sure the new guys that come in, that I make sure that they fit in and make it as seamless as possible. And, you know, that's my job. This is the third game in a row my voice is gone. And so, you know, I'm just trying to have the communication at an all-time high for us, for the new guys, and for the rest of the guys here as well.
You know, I don't know that I've even heard him mention that GM's name in public before. That tells you how happy he is with him. The biggest concern before the trade deadline wasn't just that the Cavs were dragging on the court or toxic in the locker room. It was that LeBron was getting run down. Now LeBron seems like a whole new player. As I said at that time, the biggest part of these moves wasn't Cleveland getting Nance or Clarkson or Hood. It's the possibility that the Cavs might get a rejuvenated LeBron. And 2 games in, that seems like that's the case. That's the biggest thing of all. Now, again, it's only 2 games. I'm not going to hand the Cavs the East just yet. It is a long season. We're not even to the All-Star break yet. It's a work in progress. But this gutting and this rebuilding of the airplane while it's in mid-flight has been extremely impressive. And if you're a Cleveland fan, you've got to be pumped. The season was circling the drain, and now they're alive once again. And I just want to hammer home this point. LeBron is rejuvenated. LeBron is re-energized. I mean, of course, right? The guy no longer has to work with guys that he hates, who suck the energy out of the room, and who are too old, too busted up, too selfish, and who do not fit together on the floor. Of course, this guy's showing life once again. He looks like he turned the clock back 5 years. He likes his job again. He's not miserable getting up and going to the office. He's not just going in to punch the clock. He's not going in looking to punch one of his teammates. The guy wants to be there. He wants to be there again because the guys who didn't are gone. And I don't even blame LeBron for being as miserable as he was. Who wants to work with people they don't like? Who wants to work with people who do not pull their weight, who suck all the positive energy out of a room, and who are not about team? It's amazing how much better things go when you play for each other as opposed to hating each other. When you pick each other up rather than quitting on each other like the previous group did. Once again, that'll happen when you replace toxic, bitter old guys that don't fit together with younger, more athletic, more versatile guys that actually like each other and want to be there. It's only 2 games, but it could not have gone any better than it has. I'm impressed. Denzel Perryman in studio. Denzel, good to have you, man. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. Let me start with your time at Miami. Before we get into this past season with the Chargers, you got to take me back. You went to Coral Gables High School growing up. What were those days like, and what was it like for you when you received the offer from the U?
I still remember that day, man. I was actually in history class, and, you know, my coach called me down to, you know, to the weight room. Yeah, that's what his office was. And Coach Michael Barrett was sitting in there. You know, he stood up and he was like, son, I'd like to, you know, verbally commit, you know, verbally offer you, you know, to the University of Miami. And at the time, you know, I was a freshman going into, you know, my spring year. So I was, you know, I was pretty shocked. But just being at Miami, man, it was, actually being in Coral Gables. I mean, it was right down the street anyway. So my senior year, I used to leave like the last period of the day and just go down to Miami, you know, just watch the guys work out, you know, sit in Coach Barrett's office, you know, just get that Miami feel.
I gotta tell you, I'm in Los Angeles, and people talk about the U, and guys who went there understand this. Even if you know nothing about this, you kind of know. I mean, when you go to Miami, and especially when you play linebacker, that means you're going to be a part of a long, historic tradition. I mean, every time I've ever spoken to anybody who's a member of the U, the legacy, the pride, it all comes out. So what did it mean to you to be a part of that program?
It meant a lot, man. Like you just said, you know what you're getting into when you go to Miami. You know, it's all about carrying that legacy. And, you know, especially being a linebacker and wearing number 52, you know, you got big shoes to fill. And I remember, you know, Ray Lewis came and talked to us my freshman year. And, you know, I put him to the side. You know, he asked me what number I was wearing. I was like, you know, 52. He was like, no, I'm going to be watching you. So, you know, it was just, you know, motivation like that.
Talk about that number. I mean, is that like a challenge? Is that something you embraced, or was there a part of you like, man, I don't know if I want that number? How did you approach that number?
That was my first, that was my first number of me playing football, period. And okay. It was because of Ray Lewis.
All right, now you got Ray Lewis, and then you got a guy like Jonathan Vilma. Now, Jonathan Vilma is another dude that I've talked to over the years. This guy's got a really strong presence, man. Like, serious intensity. I know that's somebody that you referenced quite a bit when you were coming up. What kind of an impact did he have on you?
He had a great impact. I actually met him when I was in high school. My college coach and him were best friends, you know, growing up. And, you know, the impact that he had on me is more like, you know, a big brother, a mentor, you know, and a guider. And, you know, like you said, you know, that strong presence, you know, it's just he walk in the room, you know, all eyes on him. And, you know, he's a big competitor, especially in bowling.
Oh, especially in bowling. Oh, yeah, bowling. No kidding. How'd that go?
He can tell you that. Denzel
Perryman joining me in studio. You know, so we fast forward a little bit. You were drafted by the Chargers in 2015. You were second on the team in tackles as a rookie. So what was that transition like from elite college football to the NFL? Was it like you expected, or maybe not so much so?
Maybe not so much so. I would say, you know, coming from college to the NFL, you have a lot of free time on your hands. So, you know, you really don't know what to do with that free time. You know, I had guys, you know, like Corey Legent, Manti Te'o, you know, Jahlil Adai. Who else we had on the team? Donald Butler. You know, I had those type of guys, you know, basically, you know, guide me on what to do, you know, how to take care of your body, you know, what to eat, and, you know, basically study film.
So initially, when you're not used to all that free time, how did you feel that free time? Because obviously it gets guys into trouble. If you can't handle it, you can make some bad decisions. How did you feel the free time initially?
First of all, I started talking to those guys. You know, I just sit at home, play video games, man.
Sure.
Do that a whole lot. And, you know, I just talk to my kids.
No, I mean, there are much worse things to do. But you find out that once you start pulling a paycheck, it's all about getting your mind right, getting your body right, doing the right things. And then you follow up that strong rookie season by leading the team in tackles in 2016. So as you were getting ready for 2017, what kind of expectations did you have?
My expectations for 2017, you know, just to play, you know, full season, which I haven't done yet. And, you know, I say that's one of my goals, you know, this year. But, you know, just approaching the 2017 year, you know, just be more of a leader, more vocal. And, you know, instead of just leading by example, you know, use my voice.
We're talking about injuries, though. You missed the first 8 games of the year with a torn tendon in your ankle, and it was a non-contact injury, but somehow you managed to walk yourself off the field with a torn tendon. So when it first happened, what did that feel like, and did you know how bad it was?
No, I didn't know how bad it was. At first, I was kind of scared because I thought it was my Achilles. Hmm. You know, I just felt something pop, so I really didn't know what it was. But, you know, when I walked off the field, you know, I even do it myself, and I got in the car, and I'm like, you know, this can't be, you know, as bad. Then, you know, x-rays came in, found I had to have surgery, and that's when, you know, it kind of hit me.
We're talking to Denzel Perryman, and see, I mean, I think that a lot of fans don't know, right? We know that you play with this risk. We know guys get hurt. They go away. They rehab, but we don't know exactly what goes into this and what it's about. Like you were talking about, the first night after surgery was the worst pain you had ever experienced in your entire life. And I completely respect this. You said that you cried the first night after you got home from the hospital. Can you even explain what that pain was like?
You know, you're just sleeping, you know, all the meds, you know, wearing off, you know, after surgery. That's basically what happened. I woke up in the middle of the night and literally, you know, I ain't have no medicine, you know, nothing like that because I got that the next day. But I woke up, man, you know, my fiance, you know, she grabbed me, you know, she told me it's going to be all right. But like, I literally cried. Like, that was the most excruciating pain I ever felt in my life.
It's probably something you never want to feel ever again.
Oh, no.
So, as everybody knows, the team gets off to an 0-4 start. I mean, what's it like for you that you're watching the team and you're seeing this whole thing unfold on the field? You want to be out there in the worst way possible to rejoin that fight, but you can't do it because physically you can't go. What was that time like?
That time, man, for me, it was more just becoming more a student of the game. You know, like you said, you know, we started off rough. You know, you want to be out there with your team, but, you know, you physically can't. So I say it's, you know, more of one of those mental things. You know, I had, you know, the coaches, you know, my family, you know, everybody just backing me up to make sure I didn't go on a dump, you know, and just, you know, stay away from football. But, you know, that whole time off, you know, I understood the game more, you know, looking from the sidelines, you know, how coaches say, like, you know, you just see it from a different point of view, you know, you'll get, you know, what we're saying. And, you know, that whole time me being off, just sitting on the sideline, that's what I was doing. You know, just becoming more student of the game, you know, helping out my teammates, you know, seeing things that they didn't see.
So you made the most of the time. So not only are you rehabbing this injury, but you're working on your head as well. When you talk about, it's good to have a support group so you don't go into the dump. I mean, is it depressing? Like, what are the types of things that you deal with when you get hurt?
Like that depression state, you know, like, oh, you know, I'm always hurt. You know, like for my case, I haven't played the full 16 season yet. So, you know, that kind of runs in my mind. But, you know, like I said, you know, as long as you got that support system, you know, you're going to be all right.
All right, so you do the work. You go through the process of rehab, and then you're finally allowed back on the field for a regular season game against Jacksonville. What'd that feel like? I mean, was that just business as usual, just another game? Or were you amped up to be playing once again? And how did it feel when you hit the field?
I was amped up, man. Like, all my hairs was just rising. You know, it felt like, you know, my first game, you know, playing football, period. You know, just being out that long and being back in, you know, I was just anxious to hit somebody.
Denzel Perryman joining me here in studio. We're talking about the L.A. Chargers. You know, it's been so easy for that team to rip apart when they started 0-4. So how much pride do you take in the fact that this team not only didn't fall apart, but instead it came together? And what's it say about everybody in that locker room?
I take a lot of pride in that. You know, one word, you know, Coach had told us from the beginning when we started off 0-4 is, you know, we just got to finish. And you know, that says a lot about, you know, coach and staff, you know, the people in the locker room and, you know, the people that work in the building, you know, with us, you know. Everybody's tied, you know, to the Chargers family. And I would say, you know, for the guys in the locker room, man, you know, that we got a lot of fight in us.
It's a lot of heart and a lot of character in that locker room. And I think it starts with your head coach, Anthony Lynn. You mentioned him. I've had him on the show a number of times. And we talk about the role that he played in keeping that team together, keeping guys focused when things were not going so well. I mean, how would you describe him as a head coach and kind of the culture and the atmosphere that he created?
As a head coach, man, I feel like, you know, I call him a cool head coach, man. You know, every time I see him, you know, I'm like, you know, what's up, coach? You know, what's on your mind? You know, look like you're thinking about something. You know, just, you know, start a conversation with him. And, you know, he'll do the same thing with you. If you just see you walking in the hallway, ask how you doing, ask how your family doing. And, you know, just as far as him as a coach, man, like, you know, he can relate to the players. You know, he has no problem, you know, stopping practice, you know, restarting the whole period. And sometimes, you know, he'll let the players do it.
Like, so he's a cool head coach because he's accessible and you can, like, you know, the door's always open, or he's just a cool dude?
Nah, both, actually. You know, right. The door's always open. You know, he's just, you know, a cool guy, period.
Denzel Perryman joining me. I agree with you. I mean, even as a media guy, I like talking to that guy. There's something about him. He's got that it. He doesn't show up to do the show. He's real. Yeah. You know, he's not going into head coach mode, giving you a bunch of crap answers. He's a real dude. You can talk to him, right?
Same guy every day.
All right, so you're part of a defense that includes talent, like at every single level. Joey Bosa, Melvin Ingram up front, the rest of the linebacking core. And then you've got so much talent on the back end, too, with guys like Casey Hayward. So when this group is healthy, what's the upside? How good can this defense be next season?
We can be really good, man. Just like you just said, the main thing is, though, we just got to be healthy. You know, got a nice front four, linebacking core, you know, we're nice. And back there, you know, pick your poison.
Now, I hate to say it, but so much of it, you can scheme up, you can coach up, you can do all the prep you want. So much of it's luck. So much of it's luck, right? Just guys staying healthy.
Yeah.
How much of it is just good fortune?
I don't know, man.
You don't want to jinx it.
No, I really don't.
I know, I hear you. All right, so what about the offseason? How do you go about approaching the offseason? Have you given yourself a chance to relax and recover from the regular season, or are you hitting this thing hard already and are you back in your routine?
Honestly, I probably started working out last week, but I like to take, you know, a month off, you know, let all my injuries, you know, little knickknacks that I have, you know, just heal up in general. You know, I'm going to take a vacation my second offseason, though. But, you know, now, you know, just relaxing, don't let the body heal, you know, let me rest, catch up, you know, the rest that I did miss. But, actually, I come back from, you know, this little trip to Miami. I'm about to get back into it.
All right. So does that month give your body enough time to heal up? Or could you use it? It's good?
Does. Yeah. Like, I probably remember just taking naps. Like, I never take naps at all. Like, taking naps with my daughter, you know, just waking up like, okay, well, it's 8 o'clock now, so what do I do?
Dude, nap nation. I mean, I want to be that guy so badly. I can't figure it out. But naps are always good, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. I'd be watching TV, you know, before I know it, it's 9 o'clock.
So I was going to say, I mean, like the power nap, the 29-minute nap, or can you nap it out for a couple hours?
I nap it out for a couple hours.
Yeah, but you know, you have two girls, right? How old?
4 and 2.
Okay, well, I know this. My boys are 16 and 12. You sleep when they sleep or you don't sleep, right?
Exactly. Like, I made that mistake one time. I fell asleep with both of them in the house. I woke up, shoes are everywhere, toilet paper was everywhere, toys everywhere, refrigerator open. Like, yeah, it was
okay,
bad.
I wasn't even talking about that, but you're right. That's a really, really good point. I'm talking about how if they're up at night, you're going to be up at night. So you sleep when they sleep to make sure you get some sleep. But you better be awake when they're awake, because who knows what they'll do to the house. All right. Now, you played in San Diego for the first few years of your career. What's the transition like moving from San Diego to L.A.?
I've moved from San Diego to L.A. A big transition. You know, you got guys, you know, I haven't been on the team. It's going to my fourth year, but, you know, guys like Phillip Rivers, Antonio Gates, Kellen Clemens, you know, guys who were on the team for a long time, you know, had established family, you know, got kids and all that stuff like that, you know, in schools down there. I said it was more harder for them, you know, just for the transition. You got to move from San Diego. You've been here all your life. Now you got to go to a new city, you know, start all over. And that's basically what we all had to do. But I'll say, you know, the more challenging thing now, and probably, you know, might be, you know, for the next 2 years, you know, just getting, you know, that fan base out here.
Yeah, that's the biggest thing. I mean, it's a tough, tough town. You not only have to win in this town, you got to win a certain way. And even though this is a national show and we've got 200 stations in the United States and Canada, I got to stay local for a couple of minutes. As an example, what's it like training in Costa Mesa?
It's pretty fun, actually, man. The weather's not that bad out here, man.
It's a good
town,
dude.
It does get a little hot, though.
Does get a little hot for you?
Oh, yeah.
Come on, you're a Miami guy.
Yeah, but, you know, I've been in Miami. Like, I've been out of Miami for a while.
Okay. So. All right, then. How about the local flavor? Have you gone to the legendary OC Fair?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
No, I haven't. I need to get out there.
Have you picked a beach, a local beach yet?
Nope.
Dude, what are you doing out here? Just on the grind, man.
Sitting at home, relaxing now.
No, I see you working. Let me go back to something else. You said that you were going to wait for a vacation for your second off season. Mm-hmm. How come you're going to wait? Why not get that thing in right now?
Right now, you know, I'm just focusing with the family right now. You know, just having that time with them.
Good for you. That's smart. Listen, before you go, what about that LA market? We touched on this. Man, it's different. You need to win. You need to win a certain way. Do you feel any extra pressure with the Rams having the year that they had in that fight for the hearts and mind of LA?
I won't say pressure. You know, we just need to win, man. You know, we had, you know, some losses that should have been wins. You know, some teams, you know, just flat out, you know, just beat us. But I won't say no pressure, man. We just need to get out there and do what we do. And we have a healthy team, and we're definitely going to make it.
So one last thought. You said your favorite road stadium in the AFC West is Arrowhead. What is it about that place? I mean, is it that it's that loud? Is it the opportunity to go in there and shut those people up? What do you like about that place?
It's loud, and you take it back to my UM days, man. That Florida State chant that they do, the chief, all that stuff, you know, the hand gestures, like, it just threw me back to the college rival game, and that's what amps me.
So why don't we talk Twitter for a minute? Not only for you, but for other people. Or I might be talking to you when I talk about this story. Twitter.com has been around now for about a dozen years. Yours truly, at Jim Rome, has been on that site for just over 8 of those years. Yet it still baffles the hell out of me that people do not know how to use that service. It's not that hard. It's really not that hard a platform. It's not that hard an app. Let me help you out. Here are a few ground rules for using Twitter. An example, Twitter now allows for 280 characters, but you should always keep it under 140. Always. If you want to use Twitter on this show and you want me to read your tweet or turn around your tweet, keep it to 140 or less. I don't care that Twitter uses 280. We use 140. And if you're spending, because if you go beyond 140, if you hit 141, Alvin is going to hammer you.
Stop. Hammer time.
Give me back my 140.
Too much down there, man.
You see what Alvin did there? Now that's something to celebrate. That fat alarm, not so much. What Alvin did right there, that's the Twitter alarm, the 280 alarm. Alvin, do that one more time.
Stop. Hammer time.
Give me back my 140.
Too much down there, man.
Give me back my 140. There is too much down there, man. That's brilliant. Twitter might be 280. We're 140. And if you're one of those people waiting to bust me when I go 141, you're wasting your time. You're never going to catch me because I'm never going to do it. Another piece of advice if you're on Twitter. If you're shooting off DMs, make sure it's a DM and not a tweet. Somebody makes that mistake every single day. Also, if you're on Twitter, never, ever tweet drunk. If you know you're drunk, put your phone down. If you've had too much to drink, do not go near your lapper. Never, ever tweet drunk. And always, always, always look for the blue check when tweeting at celebrities. Let me repeat that. Look for the verified blue check. If they've got a blue check, that means that's them. There are lots of faux celebrities. There's a lot of knuckleheads pretending to be people that they are not on Twitter. The only way you know is if they have a blue check. That means they're verified. Look for the blue check when you tweet at a celebrity. As an example, at Shire Cody. Hit former L.A. Laker forward and current Cleveland Cavalier Larry Nance Jr. with the following tweet. At LarryDN22. He tweets, at Larry Nance, quote, Larry Nance, what you did to those girls is despicable. I hope you rot in prison. End quote. The hell is this guy talking about? This is when Nance tweets back, and I quote, "Wrong guy, bud. You're looking for the gymnastics guy." Oh, that's right. This dude mistook Larry Nance Jr. for Larry Nassar. Classic mistake, right? I'm sure it happens all the time. I bet Nance gets mistaken for Nassar almost every single day. Actually, he doesn't. And you know why that is? Because they're two totally different names. Two drastically different guys with totally different names. One guy is a budding power forward in the NBA, rubbing elbows with LeBron James in Cleveland. The other guy is one of the worst guys ever. Pure human filth, rubbing elbows with prison guards for the rest of his vile existence. One of the worst guys ever. Larry Nance, bright NBA star. Nassar, one of the worst guys ever. I mean, this is not like confusing Ravens broadcaster Jerry Sandusky for Jerry Sandusky. They have the same name. Different spelling, same name. I mean, that's bad. That's bad. But on some level, I can see where that might happen. Maybe. But mistaking Larry Nance Jr. for Larry Nassar, and on Twitter, of all places. This is why peeping for the blue check is so important before you tweet. Don't be in such a rush. Don't be in such a hurry. Make sure you know who you're tweeting at. Even if you don't, just do yourself a favor and maybe peep the guy's profile. Pretty sure even one of the worst guys ever, Nassar, was on Twitter, I'm pretty sure his bio would not read Cleveland Cavaliers. Nor would his profile picture be of him helping a kid dunk a basketball. Pretty telltale signs that this is not the human scum that you're looking for, bud. People, Twitter.com is a free service. It's not that hard to use. Follow a few of the rules that I laid out for you and make the internet a better place. Peep the profile. Look for the verified blue check. It might keep you from telling a Cavs forward that he should rot in prison when the guy really did nothing wrong. Kevin Harvick is my guest. Kevin, good to have you back. How are you?
Well, thanks for having me. I'm doing great.
Good, Kevin. It's Wednesday of race week, but more importantly, of course, Wednesday before the Daytona 500. So what's the mood like among your team and your crew right now with only a couple of days before the big race?
Well, this is, as most people know that don't follow racing, this is our biggest race of the year. Most people don't know. This is our biggest race of the year, but it is our first race. So for us, you have the most anticipation of any race that you go to of the year and our biggest race. And that comes with lots of sponsors and people and fans and also a lot of obligations building up to the race. So it's a very unique race just because of the fact that we have our first race. Is our biggest race of the season.
You know, it is unique that you start the season with the biggest race, but still the Daytona, there's just something about Daytona. You've won, so you know especially. Winning the Daytona 500 is the dream of every single driver. So how does it feel when you actually do it the way you did in 07? And can you put into words what makes it so different and so special?
Well, you look at the Daytona 500, and as a NASCAR competitor, you realize very quickly that there's no bigger race to win on our schedule than the Daytona 500, just for the fact that Daytona has been such a big part of making NASCAR racing what it is. And when you look at the greats of our sport, such as Rusty Wallace and Tony Stewart, who haven't won the race who didn't win the race throughout their career, you know, you realize that it's tough to win. It took Dale Earnhardt 20 years to win at probably his best racetrack. So it's very hard to put everything together on one particular day to win the Daytona 500. But when you actually do, and you hold that trophy up, and then you do all the functions that come with it the next week, and you hear yourself introduced as the Daytona 500 champion, there's just nothing like it that any other race can even come close to.
Kevin Harvick joining us. You won the race in 2007, but just barely over Mark Martin. In fact, by 0.020 seconds. When you look back on that race, what sticks out to you the most?
Well, I think the thing that sticks out to me the most is the fact, I think with 12 or 13 laps to go, I think we were 28th or 30th, somewhere right in there, and we made a big run through the pack and were able to beat one of our sport's greatest drivers by a few inches at the start-finish line with a huge wreck following us to the start-finish line. So it's definitely one of those moments where you're a little bit surprised just because of the fact of how far behind we were, and then to win the race and drive into victory lane. And for me, it's really not about – I get more excitement and more enthusiasm out of seeing the excitement in my team and the people that work on the car and seeing how excited they are than I do for myself, because those are the guys that you're in there with every week. And so seeing them happy is just the highlight of pulling into victory lane for me.
Kevin Harvick joining us. The Daytona 500 is coming up on Sunday. You know, speaking of the team and the car, last season the team made the switch from Chevrolet to Ford. Transitions like that bring with them a lot of challenges, sometimes even more challenges than you might initially expect. You know, from the outside, correct me if I'm wrong, I would argue that you qualified for the championship four, you finished third overall. It would seem like you and the team handled those challenges really, really well. What was the transition like then?
Well, as you know, the backbone of any business is great people, and I think that the transition showed how good our people are and how good my team in particular is. But when you look at the transition from Chevy to Ford for us, you know, I think that from the outside looking in, you would say, well, they're just going to cut the bodies off and put Ford bodies on. But for us, the infrastructure, I guess, would be the best way to put it, of your database and all the information that you have and your engineering staff increasing. And we added about 100 people and did a lot more things within our own walls at Stewart Haas Racing than we did before. So there were a lot of growing pains on the production side, where we build the cars and CNC all the parts and pieces and everything that goes with it. And things were changing so rapidly, it was hard for the production side to keep up with the research and development side. So it was a very interesting year. Something as a guy who has been a team owner before and loves the challenge of trying to put the different pieces and aspects of what it makes it all to go around, it was a lot of fun, but it was a lot of work for a lot of people. And in the end, strength of the people showed.
We're talking to Kevin Harvick. The Daytona 500 is coming up on Sunday once again. You know, it's the start of your fifth season with Rodney Childers as your crew chief. The way he tells the story, you'd been working on him for maybe 9 or 10 months to get him to come over and work with you. Is that how that went down? And what did you see in him that made you feel like the two of you would be a really good combination?
Well, I did everything but beg him, and I may have begged him a few times, but sure. I don't know that I can admit it. But
right.
You know, Rodney is a very interesting person, just for the fact that he's very loyal. And you know, I think as I got into being around him more and more, and really courting him to come to Stewart Haas Racing, I realized that we had a lot in common as well. And in the way that we came up, he raced go-karts, late model stock cars. You know, wanted to keep going and took the crew chief route when the driver route ended for him, but we're very similar in age. We have a family, both have families, and have just so many things in common that for me, the off-track personal relationship was felt like it was going to be really strong. And from a professional side of things, I felt like, you know, we were different, but we both had the same approach. And when I say different, his demeanor is very laid back and calm, and mine is high-strung and outspoken. So it's been a good balance. And I think as we went through those, you know, 8 to 10 months of trying to get him over to Stewart Haas Racing, I got to know him very well. And I think the time that we were able to spend with each other to learn that relationship and learn who each other were has paid over tenfold in what we've done on the racetrack, because we have so much trust and belief and know each other so well.
Twitter at M Piazza's back knee. That handle should tell you all you need to know about the content that is sure to follow. I mentioned that when Rex Albuquerque called, he talked about Colorado Springs getting an In-N-Out burger and that everybody would be coming in for it. And I said, there's not a hamburger anywhere worth driving 400 miles for. So this guy tweets, quote, "Any burger is worth driving 400 miles. Regards, Dane Cook." Yes, I saw the photos over the weekend with Dane Cook and his 19-year-old girlfriend on a beach someplace. No, I'm not talking about it, because I really don't care. Alvin. Hey, Alvin, let me ask you something. Alvin, can you not hear me talking to you over the fat alarm? Hey, Alvin, why don't you situate yourself in front of the microphone for 1 second? I need help with something. Is there a way to turn that thing off? Alvin, can you remind me as to why there is...
Hey, Jim.
Yeah, hey, Alvin. Can you remind me why we even have a fat alarm when I've made it really clear on the program that personal appearances are not show fodder and that we sure as hell are never, ever going to fat shame anybody? Why do we have a fat alarm even? And why is it still going off?
We have it because clones would alert us to people who got fat.
Yeah, I know they do that, but I don't want them to do that, nor do I want to acknowledge it. And you could see where maybe if you develop something like that, you're encouraging it.
I get it. Miscommunication. I thought you said you wanted a fat alarm, so I played it.
Oh, really?
You don't want the fat alarm.
Got it. Okay. You got that now, Alvin?
Thank you very much.
Get your ass back over there and delete that file. Can I tell you something? Never mind the breakout star of the Olympics. Alvin DeLauro is the new breakout star of the XR4TI, and he didn't even need to tattoo an animal on his arm to do so. Of course, Alvin is like a 15-year overnight sensation. Bro, like, I had no idea you had that kind of game. Where's it been? I said, I have no idea. Had no idea you had that kind of game, and Alvin said, dude, I don't. Dude. Anyway, I'm aware of the pictures of Dane Cook. For the last time, hopefully, in the history of this show, just because I'm not talking about something doesn't mean that I'm not aware of it. They pay me to know these things. I know all these things. You know how I know these things? I sit around all day long working and grinding and looking for things. I'm responsible for 3 hours of content on the radio and on TV and across all of our platforms. Trust me, you haven't seen something that I haven't seen. Just because I'm not talking about it doesn't mean I haven't seen it. How many of you idiots are like, oh, I got to get this to Rome. Look how fat Dane Cook looks. Rome's going to want that. Speaking for Rome, Rome does not want that. Rome doesn't care about that because it's neither here nor there and it has nothing to do with anything. At least nothing to do with anything that I care about. So yeah, I've seen it. I just don't care. Alvin, I'm not playing now. Don't fire that fat alarm ever again. In fact, the best way to ensure that is just to delete the file. Delete the file. There you go. Appreciate you tuning in. Appreciate all the love for Ep 24 of the Jim Rohn Podcast with Molly Bloom. She was amazing. If you have not checked that out yet, you want to do it right now. You can thank me later. And check right back here tomorrow for more. I'll see you then. I'm out.